It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about maniacal muscle men and reproductive rituals. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of Jay Lugo and Teague Reed are voice talent Steve Gray, Melissa Medina, and Kevin Barberi. Now, get your ticket ready. Take your seat in our theater of the minds and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is written by Jay Lugo and performed by Kevin Barberi. In it, a wrestler on the wrong side of his glory days sees a ghost from his past. There's only one problem. This particular ghost isn't dead yet. What follows is a story about grief, ghosts, and grappling with your own misdeeds. Now, without further ado, I present to you Dark Match.
Cannibal had made up his mind a few moves ago. If this kid doesn't swing this chair, doesn't absolutely fucking nail me, then he's getting taxed, and big time. The kid's name is Rob Small, and he's supposedly some hotshot rookie fresh out of the local school. But Cannibal doesn't get it. Everything about the kid bugs him, right down to the name. The sport lost something when people stopped calling themselves ridiculous things like the big this or ultimate that. And besides, it's a dirty trick. It's too easy, just like everything the new kids are doing. It's almost too real. And the audience doesn't want real. They only think they do. Cannibal knows this better than just about anyone. Cannibal feels that he's been carrying them both since the bell. Again, it's this new soft shit, flipping and posing, and nobody wants a single scratch on their pretty mugs. The word fake doesn't exist in this business. But as Rob winds up for another one of his little tricks, all flair, no impact, you can kind of see where people get that idea. Cannibal takes a knee, then another, but wide, because that's how you take a real hit. Rob pulls the chair back.
"Don't fuck this up," Cannibal says.
The blade of the chair just grazes Cannibal's eyebrow, opening 2 inches of scar tissue and perforation. This is good. Unintentional, but good. The crowd isn't theirs yet, but the stream of blood pulls a few people forward and gets them almost leaning into the next row down. The blood is good, no doubt about it, but the sound of skull on steel would have lit them on fire. And that's just science. Rob moves to the ropes, taking a squeaky clean moment to acknowledge the crowd. He waves his arms around like he's leading a marching band or something, and it earns him a small pop of recognition. Here's the problem. There's no story here. No tale of the tape. Just some rookie nobody cares about, and an aging prick that people care even less about. This is when every move is supposed to count. Not just every move, but every transition, every facial expression too. The kid's athletic, sure, but so is everybody. He doesn't have the rhythm yet, and his nose is too straight. And Cannibal is tired of carrying this match. Cannibal starts back on his feet, quickly, counterintuitively, like a jump scare. The kid's finally connecting with the crowd now, lifting the chair like some intramural trophy. But it's too little, too late, and Cannibal sees his opportunity. First, Cannibal snatches the chair up and behind Rob, then steadies his giant, calloused fingers with a well-timed exhale. He whirls Rob around, ready or not, and drives the lip of the chair into the liver side of his waist, which folds him directly in two. The crowd chatters a bit, but he isn't finished. Cannibal throws the chair less than a foot away, then sets up the move that's going to win the crowd. He didn't invent the move, not even close. It's not even particularly uncommon. But he made his name off this move. Here's some wisdom from the old school. There are precious few people who make money from this business by looking good. And if you can't look good, you need to look vicious. Cannibal hooks his arms under Rob's armpits, then wrenches both arms so violently that the triceps almost touch. Operating on pure panic and instinct, Rob's legs unwind, independently searching for a better position, but never finding it. "Hey, easy up there," Rob says from somewhere near Cannibal's midsection, but he may as well be speaking to the mat now. Cannibal wrenches Rob's arms again, but this time the triceps touch for one moment of searing pain. He does this half for show and half as a warning to keep quiet during his finisher. He looks out at the crowd and their features form for the first time since he entered the arena. Before then, they were nothing, just a wallpaper pattern of merch and facial hair. There's a difference between the individual faces in the first row and the voice that fills the venue and guides your match. A single fan can be wrong, but a crowd never is. But Cannibal takes some of that power back now, and he's staring at the crowd, the entity, right in the face, starting with the first row. The first few faces that he locks eyes with are rabid, their eyes wild with anticipation. They're gesticulating wildly, like they can't believe or can't wait for what's coming next. The next face is a little boy who shies away and looks at his dad for help. He scans about a seating section and a half, screaming spittle-seasoned insults along the way. Mid-taunt, before anybody can count it off, Cannibal hits his finisher, the Flesh Eater. Cannibal pushes off the toes of his boots, about a foot into the air, bringing Rob's craned arms with him. That's why you really need to wrench. With Rob feeling real pain at each arm's socket, he has no choice but to sell. At the height of his jump, Cannibal shoots his legs straight out in a wide V, unclenching his ass for a nice, cushioned landing. Rob's face hits the chair, a microsecond before Cannibal's legs and underside absorbs the remainder of the blow. It's enough to make the aluminum ring out into the high warehouse ceiling and put a pretty little face-sized dent in the seat. The crowd reacts with screams, with horror, with finally some fucking emotion. Cannibal climbs to his feet while the lights flicker on and off in Rob's eyes. Rob props himself on his palms and knees, finding the floor he wasn't even looking for. But he loses it again with a big, booted punt to the ribs. The crowd boos now from every direction. This is good. It means that right now they hate Cannibal. It means that when they go home, they'll remember how much they hated him. It means that he did his job. Cannibal takes a victory lap around the ring while Rob writhes in presumably authentic agony. Cannibal leans over the top rope, pointing at the front row again, dissolving the boundary between them. He's screaming at a fan. He may even be screaming at 100 fans when he notices a face that shouldn't be in attendance. Was it Section B? He looks over but can't find the face anymore. He darts his eyes wildly, unfocusing them so that the crowd transforms into nothing but eyebrows and merch, approval and disgust. He glances back toward Section B, right around where he thinks he saw the face, right as Rob crawls from behind, hooks his leg, and rolls him into a three count. Both men roll onto their backs. Rob, because of the pain from his neck down to his waist, puts him there. Cannibal, because he's defeated and confused. Had he really seen that face? He knows he hadn't. One, because that would make no sense. And two, because, and he only saw it for a second, but the face was significantly younger than it should have been. About 20 years younger, which would put it right around a time that he doesn't think or speak about. Cannibal decides that he didn't see the face after all. He doesn't believe in ghosts, especially not ghosts that haven't even died. Cannibal collects his pay, and the doc plugs up his gash, in that order. He's got a show in a bigger market tomorrow, so the butterfly stitches just need to hold until then. He unlaces his boots in the parking lot, then trades them for some once-white Adidas from the backseat of his gray Toyota Camry. Then he thinks about the ghost again, the one that he didn't see, the one that isn't even dead as far as he knows. He stands still in his untied sneakers and thumbs a few reps through his social pages. If he had died, the news would have picked it up by now. An old friend would have even messaged, "Here if you need to talk," or "It's not your fault," something like that anyway. But Cannibal doesn't see anything. No messages, neither of their names gracing or disgracing any headlines. And besides, that doesn't exactly solve the issue at hand. Maybe the kids are right, he thinks. I've totally taken too many blows to the skull. For 20 years, Cannibal has always driven to the next city or the next stop on the road, the night prior. Tonight, he checks into the nearest hotel rest stop that connects to the main road. It's only about a 4-hour drive, 3 if he can avoid traffic and the need to piss. He doesn't even need to check into the venue until 5 p.m. That's ample time, he decides, for the first time in his career. I just need a bed and a shower, Cannibal tells the night clerk, a pimply boy who has deepened his voice since the exchange intensified. He's the only employee, except for a few maids pushing yellow baskets around the parking lot and a few unofficially affiliated girls prowling around from the local skin bar. The boy wants to avoid a hassle. He knows that the nearest signs of life are the old warehouse a few exits down and the sheriff's office even further.
I'm sorry, sir, he begins,
and he's really using his diaphragm now, speaking to the back of the house.
But all we've got left tonight is the honeymoon suite.
So it's $30 extra for a dirty mirror on the ceiling and a vase full of plastic fucking roses? The clerk winces at the swear, then gleams over Cannibal's right shoulder into the mostly empty parking lot. Cannibal gives the kid his best mean mug, the same one that he'd shoot toward a new opponent or a crowd that hates his guts. The quiet moment lingers, and then, wouldn't you guess it, just like that, $30 gets shaved off the tab. Cannibal tosses his duffel onto the frilly red sheets, then rolls off his sneakers as his reflections oblige in both the ceiling and wall-length mirrors. He sits on the bed, then wiggles his toes a bit, generating a sound like gravel crunching in a driveway. He wants to get up and shower off some of the dried blood that's clotted his hair to his face, but the world rocks and spins, and he lays down and falls asleep without even killing the bedside lamp. He can't remember the ramp, the fans, or the bell. He can't remember the promos or what angle he's supposed to be taking. But judging from the dark cherry splatted canvas and the ringing in ears, it's been a fucking barn burner so far. He looks directly ahead at the high, pipe-laden ceiling and realizes he's on his back. A boot lands next to his head, then another. Maybe it's the high-intensity discharge lights that are stinging his eyes. Maybe he's still rattled from whatever move put him on his ass. But as his opponent steps over him, he can't seem at all to make out their face. Whoever his opponent is, he begins to pick him up by the hair. And that's when Cannibal notices that the abstract art on the mat has mostly come from the back of his head. Drops of blood race down his opponent's wrists and pool near his elbows. Cannibal is bent over looking down at the mat, at his opponent's standard-issue black boots, and at the fresh coat of bright red, which will soon dry darker. His opponent cranks his arm clumsily but with intensity. He can feel his blood greasing his opponent's grip, not allowing for any real traction. Then his opponent's knees square up, then bend, and Cannibal realizes.
"Hey, that's my fucking move," he says, or tries to say.
But his opponent's airborne, and then so is he. Usually there's a nice thud when you hit the mat, but not this time. This time, it sounds more like a series of wet pops, like cracking your knuckles underwater. Cannibal tries to roll over and assess the situation. Then, he tries to roll over again. Oh, shit. He's face down on the mat, and he intuits, rather than feels, his opponent hurry off him. And in that same foggy way, he can feel the crowd. The beast with 1,000 eyes is silent, but it isn't bored. It's murmuring, but with a sort of upward inflection, like it's asking him a question he can't answer. Now, a referee rolls him over. Cannibal awakens in a panic and tries to jump out of bed, away from the red sheets. But his body is uncooperative. His head lolls at an unnatural angle toward the mirrored wall. He can move his eyes, but nothing else. He wants to scream for the pimply-faced boy or one of the night girls, but nothing comes out of his mouth. He can see his reflection, the collapsed muscles in his face, and the pool of spit that collected on the pillow by his ear. The parts of the bed directly under him appear a darker red than the rest of the sheets. His eyes roll wildly and take in different parts of the same wall that he's frozen on. He can barely feel his breathing, but he knows that it's sporadic and shallow. He keeps rolling his eyes, searching for a modicum of control over his own body, and that's when he sees him again. The ceiling mirror casts its reflection into its wall counterpart, and with the furthest strain of his eyeball muscles, Cannibal can just barely recognize him. He's a little older than he looked in the crowd earlier, but it's unmistakable this time. Fucking ghosts. Ghosts who aren't even dead yet. From somewhere behind his eyes, Cannibal feels the onset of rage. His eyes blink involuntarily, and a well of tears are pushed and guided down into the spit-soaked pillow. He imagines himself rocking forward and tries to send this signal to a part of his body that doesn't exist. He imagines it again. He tries to kick a leg, throw an elbow. He'll settle for anything. He sends that signal in random intervals like he's trying to surprise his own faculties. He throws another elbow. Except this time, his arm releases from his side and soars out in front of him. His body follows, and he feels a vile concoction of fear and relief as he falls off the bed, with arms and legs too weak to break his fall. He narrowly avoids contact with the corner of the nightstand and lands with a thud on the carpeted floor. He wiggles his toes, and the sound of tires on gravel rings out into nothing. After regaining some strength, Cannibal uses his recently renewed limb strength to tear through every creak and crack of the hotel room. He finds nobody in the room, nobody in the mirrors, just himself and his aching fucking cranium. Exhausted, but no longer tired, Cannibal grabs his duffel and checks out of the hotel room by tossing his key in the general direction of the unsuspecting clerk. He tears his car door open, then drives off with only half a plan in mind. The morning sun breaks as Cannibal pulls up to a red light and rereads his early morning text to the promoter. "Can't make it tonight. I'll make it up to you somehow." He's never backed out of a show before, and he knows that he'll have to confront that fact soon. But right now, it doesn't seem to matter. He needs to see him. He cobbles his route out of headlines and news stories that he manages to search up between red lights and stop signs. Where are they now? Six wrestlers whose careers ended in tragedy. The real story of Ernie the Eagle Samson. Former world champion contender in hospice after 20-year battle. Cannibal's mind races as single sentences fire out at him like shrapnel. He scrolls past his own names, both gimmick and government, a few times over. He feels the rage, and tears form behind his eyes again. "You weren't the only one that lost your legacy that day, you prick." After 20 years, he knows these roads well.
well enough to cruise over to the hospice unassisted by a map or GPS, he acknowledges his thoughts as his motions become routine. Ernie Sampson was poised to be the next big thing back before all the wrestling territories got swallowed up by the big guy in the corporate machine. He was a handsome bastard and a city man with the strength of a farm boy. He could talk fear into the crowd without raising his voice, and he pulled women who didn't know and didn't care what he did for a nightly living. Cannibal hated him, but in a brotherly way that was steeped in admiration. Even in those times, Cannibal was more brutish and uglier than everyone in the locker room. It was a stroke of momentary genius when some otherwise dipshit promoter first suggested that they pair up. Some sort of beauty and brawn type gimmick. The monster and his mouthpiece. And you know what? It worked. People ate that shit right up. Cannibal chewed through his opponents with ferocity, while Ernie dazzled the crowd with his mixture of strong style, flips, and tricks. They melted the imaginary territory perimeters and became shooting stars in every market they played. Men paid off their tabs at the bar, and Ernie was gracious enough to send some trim Cannibal's way every now and again. It was a nice system, comfortable even. Then that dipshit promoter had another bright idea. The team was ready to break up. The way he described it, they'd take all that heat they had amassed together and cover double the ground. This storyline was natural, mostly because it was real. What the promoter was saying, in his dickhead way, was that Cannibal had served his purpose. He'd put the real star in place for his meteoric rise. Cannibal looked at where his career was and how far it had come, and he agreed. They'd go out in one final bloodbath of a match and defeat their current rivals, the Maniacs. Then, Cannibal would attack Ernie, severing their ties and launching their individual careers. Cut, dry. Right up until the end, that match stands in Cannibal's memory as his finest work. If he'd been vicious before, he was rabid in this match. The hits were real, the emotions were high, and the crowd invested in every last pectoral twitch. After nearly half an hour of slogging and bruising, Cannibal hit his finisher and covered his opponent to the tune of 20-something thousand screaming fans. As the three count fell, the crowd hit a decibel that he'd never heard before. They were screaming so loud that it almost dampened in volume and became a whisper in his ears. The Maniacs had done their jobs well, bloodying and bruising Cannibal and Ernie for a gruesome glamour shot that would make the following day's paper. That image of Ernie raising Cannibal's arm before the inevitable turn would haunt almost every article written about either of them from that day forward. Soaking in the moment and each other's blood, Ernie hoisted Cannibal's arm and they spun the ring, facing every single fan in attendance. Normally, you'd wait for a break in the volume before the next big moment, but this crowd had no intention of quieting down. They faced each other, and Ernie mouthed the words, "You ready?" To this day, Cannibal doesn't exactly know what went wrong. First, he felt sadness. Then he felt anger. He realized that the cheers wouldn't end for Ernie, but there was a very real possibility that this was his own last big pop. He went ahead as planned, first with an absolutely brutal kick to the midsection, which softened Ernie's abs into dough. Ernie let out a real, dry cough as the crowd's cheers morphed into shock and confusion. Then he cranked his arms, clumsily but with intensity. Ernie's arms were slick with blood, and Cannibal couldn't sink in his hooks correctly. His legs shot out gracelessly, and rather than hearing the cushioned thud of his own ass, all he heard was a sick, wet pop. Cannibal notes that he is about one exit from the hospice and shakes his head vigorously as if to erase his thoughts. The exit approaches and he cuts in deftly. He is immediately greeted by a green, bustling town in a decent Midwestern neighborhood. He cruises towards the hospice, passing a few young couples and their church-clothed children. Bells chime nearby, and a dog emits a medium-sized bark from a nearby public park. Cannibal glances in his rear view as he changes lanes. Ernie is seated behind the middle console, smirking, but with no joy in his eyes. Cannibal tries to scream, but can't. With the wheel slightly angled for his turn, Cannibal cruises subtly across lanes, onto the sidewalk, then into the park. The first few couples dive out of the way with synchronized but inharmonious shrieks. A young man pushes his wife and child to the ground, and the driver's side front wheel crunches and shatters his ankle. The next few people aren't so lucky. A group of friends sprawled across a picnic blanket snap around toward the source of the commotion, just in time to greet the Toyota Camry's fender. Cannibal's eyes dart between his windshield and the rear view where Ernie sits, smirking. He sees a young woman snatch from his sightline and hears a gunshot of a pop as the back of her skull smacks against some concrete. Tears roll down Cannibal's face as he wills his arms, legs, or fucking anything to move. The litter of bodies tests the car's shocks as the wheels find their way over strange terrains of bone and flesh, then a street lamp. Cannibal's forehead smacks against his wheel a millisecond before the airbags deploy. He flinches, and his arms twitch as the bag chafes his nose and brow. He has regained control of his movement, if only slightly. He kicks open the door but does not face the trail of mayhem that succumbed to his vehicle. Instead, he realizes that he is just one block away from the hospice. With the remaining screams a comfortable distance behind him, he half runs, half stumbles to the reception desk. People react to Cannibal's arrival with appropriate confusion and terror. The butterfly stitches have ceased to hold, and a rigid pattern of blood trails him as he staggers across the linoleum tile. "Sir, do you need help?"
"Samson. I need Ernie fucking Samson."
He peers over the desk and sees a directory of sorts, like a cheat sheet of hospice patients and their assigned rooms. He leaks blood from his brow over the counter and onto the sheet, and the seated receptionist recoils with disgust as he snatches and reads it.
"Ernie Sampson, 211.
Cannibal marches now on sturdy feet to the nearest stairwell. A small security guard attempts to stand in his way, but Cannibal dwarfs his face with his gigantic palm and smashes it into the drywall behind him, eliciting a collective gasp from the lobby waiting room. He kicks open the stairwell door and drags himself up the single flight of stairs onto the landing. Then he kicks open the second door. Nurses gasp and take a step back as he emerges from the stairwell, ferocity emblazoned across his face and written in his scar tissue. He observes the direction in which the numbered rooms flow and stomps toward room 211. Half a dozen people stood outside the room, with hospital staff accounting for only two of them.
"Bradley?"
an older woman asks as Cannibal tears past her and into the room. Inside the room is a white sheet spread over a series of lumps on a lightly inclined bed. A young man is seated near the side of the bed where the railing has been temporarily removed. His eyes are bloodshot and his cheeks are damp.
"Brad, what the fuck is..." he begins to say.
Cannibal lifts his leg and boots the man right off the green cushioned chair. Then he turns to the white lumps and tears the blanket off. Ernie's face appears as it did in his back seat, but without the rigid smirk. The muscles in his face are weak and sag as if they'd collapsed several years before his death. His dull eyes are still open, still staring at Cannibal.
"Ernie, you fucking prick," Cannibal starts. "You fucking prick, you get back here right now. You gonna fuck with me? You gonna fuck with me, Ernie? I fucking made you, Ernie. We both fucking died that day."
A small militia of security guards pour into the room, and it takes every last one of them to restrain Cannibal. He fights and squirms as the fattest guard sits on the white of his back and pulls his arms. Cannibal thrashes and screams like an animal as he is restrained. He bashes his face into the tiled floor, leaving increasingly large spots of blood at the site of impact. The fat guard applies some pressure to his hold as small, wet pop emits from Cannibal's back. There's no story here, no tale of the tape. Just a has-been wrestler in tomorrow's headlines and a family mourning a loss that began two decades prior. The crowd of mourners gasp and scream as all the fight leaves Cannibal's body at once. Then a woman breaks into sobs. She used to know Bradley Hughes.
the real cannibal. But nobody wants real. They only think they do.
I hope you enjoyed Dark Match, as written by Jay Lugo and performed by Kevin Barberi. Our second tale of the evening is written by Teague Reed and performed by Steve Gray and Melissa Medina. In it, we meet Emma, a young woman working in a small diner in a remote part of Saskatchewan. She meets a customer, Bob, who triggers a strange transformation within her. The two chat, and though Emma is initially disinterested in his clumsy advances, she agrees to meet him later that night. Emma's interest in Bob, however, is not romantic. Now, without further ado, I present to you Maternal Instinct.
Coffee?
Black. No sugar.
You're gonna want to put sugar in this.
No need, Emma.
He said, his eyes lingering uncomfortably long on the name tag pinned over her left breast.
You're sweet enough for me.
Emma forced herself to smile. She didn't mind slinging coffee and greasy food, but she hated guys like this. She had seen and served all kinds of people, but this guy was the type that made the job truly awful. She had picked Dry Lake, a small town about 3 hours northwest of Saskatoon, because it was remote and quiet, with plenty of lakes and forests nearby. A good place to hide. But even here, there were no escaping guys like this. Trust me, buddy, I make this coffee. I know what it tastes like. You're gonna want sugar.
It can't be that bad.
He smiled, working hard to keep eye contact with her.
Not if you made it.
And why is that?
You're perfect.
He purred, winking. Emma wanted to say something snarky, but she curled her toes instead, keeping her eyes on the prize, the tip this jackass would hopefully leave.
Perfect.
He repeated, putting his hand on her arm. Emma gently shifted her arm away from his hand, disguising the move by pouring the coffee. She was glad there was a counter between them. I don't know if I'm perfect, she smiled sweetly. But I promise you, the coffee ain't. He picked up his cup and she tilted her head slightly to the left. Then she leaned back to watch as he sipped.
That's terrible,
he said, grimacing. So am I, she said, being honest with him for the first time.
Terrible. You?
Worse than anything you can imagine.
Nah, you're not terrible.
He laughed, adding 3 heaping spoons of sugar to his cup.
You're too hot to be terrible, and you tried to warn me. I should have listened.
Yes, you should have.
Let me make it up to you.
Leave me a big tip. That'll do it. She smiled, turning around to restart the coffee pot. He grabbed her arm gently but firmly. She felt something stir inside. It couldn't be time, she thought. It had been only a year.
Seriously, though,
he said, flashing what he obviously thought to be a charismatic smile, but that she thought made him look constipated.
How about you and me doing something? I'm here till morning. Why don't you show me around?
There's not much to see here.
That's a matter of opinion,
he said, with a cockeyed look she assumed was supposed to be smoldering. She curled her toes again. This guy was as smooth as a cheese grater. She swallowed the sarcastic comeback that rose to her lips and tried to hide the revulsion she felt as he traced her body with his eyes. Are you going to tell me what you want or not?
I thought I had,
he said, stroking her hand gently. This guy was a pig. She couldn't wait to see the back of him.
Let's have some fun. What do you say?
You just won't give up, will you? He shook his head.
Not when I see something like you.
Something like me. Charming.
You know what I mean.
She wanted to tell him that she was busy and needed to get back to work, but the feeling growing inside stopped her. The pull of instinct was taking over. A sudden shiver ran through her body and she nearly dropped the coffee pot. The hairs on her arms, the back of her neck, and her legs stood up. She closed her eyes, forcing control over herself. Her whole body began to tremble as she felt her senses come alive. This was different. This was new. It never happened this fast. She could hear the heartbeat of everyone in the place, taste the sourness of their breath mingling in the air, feel the crackling energy of their life forces crashing against her like the turbulence of storm-tossed waves slamming a beach. There was no doubt now. It was time. "The Blue Heron," she said, her voice even and calm, betraying none of her inner turmoil and excitement.
"What's the Blue Heron?"
"Tavern."
"And where's that at?"
"Buddy, Dry Lake ain't big enough for directions."
"Fair enough. My name's Bob, by the way."
"I finish at 8:30, she said, ignoring him. "I'll meet you at 9 if..."
"If what?"
"If you leave now."
"That's harsh."
"I'm busy. 9 o'clock or nothing. Can you do that?"
"And I'm supposed to trust that you'll just show up?"
"It's a big night. Gail Francis's 75th, she said, pointing to the poster on the wall to his left. "The whole town is gonna be there. I couldn't miss it even if I wanted to. People would talk. My tips would suffer." He nodded, unconvinced.
"Let me guess. Your boyfriend will be there? You show up and I get my ass kicked."
"No boyfriend."
"I find that hard to believe."
"Small town, slim pickings. I'm not from around here. I'm just passing through, really. I'll be leaving soon, and you'll be gone in the morning. That works for me. 9. Take it or leave it."
"But I'm hungry,"
he said, gesturing to the menu. "The Heron has food." He looked disappointed. "And they have beer, too. The diner doesn't."
"But the company..."
"Is working right now and is quite busy."
"Okay,"
he grunted reluctantly.
"That's the way you want it. That's the way we'll do it."
Emma watched him head out the door, her heart racing, her breathing shallow. The craving churned and boiled inside her. If he hadn't left, she would have lost all control, and Bob and the other 11 people in the diner would all be dead now. She pressed the back of her hand to her forehead. She was burning up, but she wasn't sick. She was alive. More alive than she had been in over a year. But there was something else. She had gone through this before, many times, but this was about more than the usual feeling of hunger. This was different, intense, overwhelming, and confusing. Why was she so focused only on him? If this feeling had come to her this suddenly last year, she would have taken everyone in the place. But she only wanted him tonight. There was no question. This time was different. She looked at the clock. 7:30. She didn't know if she could hold out until 9. 25 years ago, something moved deep in the earth, where light and sound have no meaning. Ancient, shapeless, and blind. It had no concept of time or of its own being, but it knew hunger. Hunger had awoken it. The creature did not appreciate that millions of years had passed since the last time it had fed. It did not even fully understand what it was to feed. But the pangs that ravaged it sent tremors of painful instinct through its body and goaded the thing to move. It began to slither and uncoil, boiling like a tangle of snakes, before making its way along the passage from the deep pit where it had slept, buried beneath the mountains, for countless millennia. Though the space was large enough for 2 African elephants to walk through side by side, the grotesque bulk of this shapeless thing filled the passage entirely. It did not crawl or drag itself through the darkness of the passageway. It oozed through the tightness of unyielding rock until, like the impossible volume of infection erupting from a lanced boil, It burst from the mountainside and flowed out into the world. Had there been someone there to witness this obscenity emerging from the narrow crevice in the sheer face of the steep escarpment, they would have seen the birth of a nightmare. An eyeless mass of flesh pulsating at the center of a confusion of tentacled limbs. Free of the confining limits of the rock, it swelled to its full size, undulating and massive. It began to feed. Its great bulk crushed a wide swath through the forest, while preposterous tentacles, each more than 14 meters long, flailed without purpose, blindly knocking down or uprooting trees. It had no mouth, but absorbed all that it enveloped with a rapacious intensity born of millennia of dormancy. When awake, this thing would scour the earth for hundreds of years, feeding and growing until instinct drove it to find a resting place. And the larger it grew, the longer the period of hibernation its slow digestion required. When last it had fed, dinosaurs had roamed the earth, and it had absorbed the giants of the Cretaceous by the millions. Had the earth a voice, it would have screamed a warning to every living thing. Intense vibrations in the air excited basic receptors on the creature's body, a potent energy that drew the thing towards it like a magnet. From the earliest moments when life first began in the great primordial ooze, it had always been the biggest, the strongest, and the hungriest. And ever and always, such vibrations had meant life, and life had meant food. The thing quickened its pace, a sickening bulging of animated flesh undulating through the forest like some appalling cross between an octopus, a bold sea elephant, and a slug. A mindless slave to instinct, it followed the vibrations, consuming everything in its path as it moved. It did not take long before it came to a place where the vibrations reached a crackling intensity that rippled across its skin and set its primitive senses afire. Had the creature the capacity for emotion, it would have felt something akin to lust. Its tentacles reached out and began coiling around the source of the vibrations. It raised itself as high as it could, reaching and grasping at the lines of vibrating power that danced on the air all around it. Over 360,000 volts of electricity tore through its soft body as it ripped the transmission towers down, causing a power outage for 130 kilometers in each direction. The creature's body was destroyed, but this thing had come into existence at the very first moments of life itself. It was beyond ancient. All it understood was survival. It was not going to vanish from the world now. Formless, reduced to a state of primordial energy, it began to move away from the place of its body's death. As it drifted bodiless through the woods, the forest's animals gave it a wide berth. Even insects fled from it. They could not see or smell it, but they could sense the malevolence moving across the land like the bow wave from an aircraft carrier. After many hours, it came upon a tent and sensed an energy that intrigued it. Within the tent, two young lovers on a canoeing trek through the wild had turned in for the evening, but had not yet gone to sleep. The disembodied essence of the creature bled its way inside, drawn by the life energies of the lovers. It enveloped the pair, but being immaterial, it could neither absorb them nor be felt by them. It pressed against the lovers, becoming one with them at the very moment when the man reached orgasm. The chemical, hormonal, and even spiritual explosion that accompanies the culmination of the sex act filled the thing with an elation it had not experienced since the very moment of its own renaissance. At the instant of conception, the energy that composed this thing was fused with the zygote of the child-to-be, creating something new, something that evolution had never intended. Today, crowded as the Heron was, it didn't take Emma long to spot Bob, sitting alone at the bar, watching a baseball game on the large screen over the whiskey shelf. Bob looked towards the door and she caught his eye.
I didn't think you would show,
he said, offering her the stool beside him. Let's get some air, Emma said, gesturing towards the door.
You just got here. Let's get a table.
Emma bristled with impatience. She was barely keeping herself together. The server, Jenny Lorenzen, walked past, balancing four pitchers on a tray. Emma noted how Bob's eyes lingered over Jenny's body as she walked by. Plan B? She smirked. He grinned back, delighted with her joke.
Could be a part of Plan A if you think she's up for it.
You're assuming I would be.
Wouldn't you?
He leered. Let's go, she said, pretending to laugh.
At least let me buy you a drink.
We can come back after. His eyes and grin widened as one.
After?
She had him. She took him by the hand and led him outside, where she breathed in the cool, quiet air. The music could still be heard pumping through the walls, but it was blissfully muted. Her mind was awash in a confusion of emotion and memories. Her thoughts were mostly of her parents. They had been her first victims, which seemed like the wrong word, but it was the most accurate, she supposed. She had been 5 when she had taken them. After that, she rested for 6 months in the sewers in Toronto. She missed her parents, but they were always with her, their memories and thoughts, as well as those of every person she had ever taken, were entwined with hers. Having many voices in her head meant that she never really felt alone. Still, tonight, along with the excitement, a deep, aching loneliness descended upon her, as though a great chasm of awareness had opened within her mind. She felt like she was standing alone in a darkness that stretched away for millions of years. What's wrong with me? She asked aloud.
Nothing, babe. Absolutely nothing,
Bob said, slapping her ass and bringing her attention back to the here and now. She picked up her pace, cutting across the parking lot. The lot was full tonight. Every pickup truck in the area must be here, she thought.
Where are we headed?
Bob asked, excited by her apparent enthusiasm. She didn't answer. She didn't know. None of this had been planned. It was like she was being controlled, pulled by a force she didn't understand but couldn't ignore. She had no idea what it wanted from her. All she knew was that she needed to get him across the road into the forest.
It's a bit dark for a hike, babe,
he said. They passed a marker and stepped into the dark of the trees. There's a cabin just a little way down here, she lied.
It's too dark. I can't see.
I can. She quickened her pace, pulling him alongside her.
Stop,
Bob said, trying to free his hand, shocked by how strong her grip was.
I said stop.
Emma barely heard him. Her body began to lose shape. Every part of her was in motion, melting, relaxing into what she had always believed to be her natural form. Bob began to struggle, but the thing that had been her hand began growing and coiling along the length of his arm like an octopus tentacle. Bob began to scream, but the snake-like appendage that held his arm reached up and wrapped itself about his face, choking his cries to silence. Turning from the hiking trail, she plunged into the bush, dragging him along behind her. She created a path in the undergrowth as she absorbed whatever she touched, Her body, barely resembling anything human, flowed like a sail as they moved deeper into the trees. After an hour, they emerged into the break in the forest created by a small lake. Behind her, Bob whimpered as the moonlight showed him the shapeless mass of meat and tissue that she had become. She had grown as she had consumed the bric-a-brac of small trees, ferns, mosses, small animals, and insects that had crossed their path, but she wasn't yet finished. Bob watched, tears streaming down his face, as Emma ingested five of the large spruce trees that lined the shore, reaching out with long, searching tendrils of flesh that emerged from what had once been her chest and tore up, cracked and absorbed the trees with grotesque ease. He watched in horror as Emma's body swelled, testing the elasticity of her skin to the limit as she became even more massive, misshapen, bloated, and engorged like a python that had swallowed a hippo. Emma pulled Bob close to what had once been her face, now stretched and distorted, carrying only the barest memory of features like a melting wax sculpture. Bob watched as a thin filament of flesh, no thicker than a phone charging cord, started to grow from the central mass of the thing that held him. The thread worked its way upwards along his body, tenderly, feeling its way from his stomach to his mouth. As it wormed its way down inside him, Bob struggled and fought with a renewed but futile vigor. His eyes widened in agony as fibers spread throughout his body, invading every part of him, pressing painfully through him like wires. Emma held him in the air, still alive, still aware, and dangled him like a fish on a hook. Spindles of flesh flowed from her, and she began to dig into the soft earth at the edge of the lake, scooping up mounds of dirt, burrowing down, and burying the two of them as easily as any excavating machine might. The weight of 10 feet of earth was as comforting as any bedding, and the cool earth felt appropriately safe and womb-like to her. Wrapped about Bob's still living, still struggling body, which was being kept alive by the umbilical thread that connected them, she began to drift off to sleep. Emma's skin tingled as she felt the life energy pulsing within him. When next she awoke, she would no longer be alone. She would be a mother.
I hope you enjoyed Maternal Instinct, as written by Teague Reed and performed by Steve Gray and Melissa Medina. On to the shows. Longtime resident Otis Gyrie has his very own show here on our network, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which you can hear every Sunday night. We also have Eric Peabody's Horror Hill, a podcast dedicated to some of our deeper and darker tales. We hope you check him out. And Drew Blood's Dark Tales airs Fridays, featuring some Southern down-home horror. And don't forget to check out the Fear from the Heartland Archives, featuring more than 120 episodes. Well, friends, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us for tonight, and remind you to take a moment to stop by our iTunes page and leave Chilling Tales for Dark Nights a 5-star review and a kind word. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram if you haven't already. And of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012. And consider signing up as a patron at our website, chillingtalesfordarknights.com, to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. I'm your host of the evening, Steve Taylor, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.